Welcome to the 2009-802.11n Wi-Fi Challenge at WebTorials, where we are discussing the importance of Wi-Fi architecture in selecting an 802.11n solution. I'm Robin Leyland, an analyst in the networking industry and host of the Challenge series at WebTorials. Joining me is Joni Wexler. Joni is a writer and analyst, the author of the Network World Wireless and Enterprise newsletter, and a longtime observer of the wireless industry. Joni will be leading the discussions. Welcome, Joni.
Thanks, Robin.
Join us to discuss what the right architecture is Luke Roy, Vice President of Wireless Strategy at Enterprise Siemens. Welcome, Luke.
Hi, Robin. Hi, Joni.
Also participating is Jeff Smith. Jeff is Vice President of Product Management at Proxim Wireless. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks a lot, Robin and Joni.
Rounding out our panel is Bruce Miller, Vice President of Product Marketing at Xeris. Welcome, Bruce.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
I'm now going to turn the session over to Joni, who will ask our first question.
Hey, thanks, Robin, and thanks, everybody, for joining us today. This is a fairly basic and core topic when you get into Wi-Fi evaluations from one vendor to the next. The architecture that each vendor promotes tends to be a big part of their argument for using their system. So I wanted to just give a little bit of background first and then ask a very high-level question. Just so the listeners can follow, when I speak of architectures, I'm referring basically to how a system is designed to operate, both from a transmission and an RF management perspective. And architectures can involve some or all elements being centralized, distributed, a little of both, and so forth. That being said, it would seem to me that enterprises actually purchase systems based on how well they perform, their cost, and perhaps some particularly innovative individual features, and along, of course, with some support and other service-oriented variables, depending on who the vendor supplier is. So this all being said, in your view, what is it about architecture that is truly relevant to the enterprise buyer that's shopping around for an 802.11n system? Basically, if people buy products, not architectures, what do they need to know about the architecture that would help sway them in their decision? And I think I would like to start with Bruce from Xeris on this one. Xeris has perhaps of the three vendors represented here, perhaps the most different architecture. Bruce, would you like to tackle that?
Sure, Joni. Thanks. With respect to 802.11n, one of the key elements tied to, say, the architecture of a product for successfully deploying Wi-Fi is based on the performance of 802.11n, which takes up the performance of A and G networks by 5 to 6 times. And so I think it's very key to look at the performance elements of the architecture. And a primary element of that is, where are you actually making the forwarding decisions? How is the traffic being directed through the network? And Xeris believes that a distributed type of architecture is much more amenable to this, where you actually are pushing the data forwarding decisions out to the edge of the network instead of taking it back to a central controller like you do with a traditional central controller and thin AP architecture. You don't get the tromboning of traffic as it heads into the core of the network and then back out. You are able to apply policies and intelligence at the edge of the network right when the traffic hits it, as opposed to doing it later when it hits into the core of the network. And then another key aspect here, I would add almost like another element to the architectural discussion is not just between distributed and centralized, but also integrated. The integration of multiple elements at the edge of the network into a single intelligent device is a key aspect that Xeris promotes with our product, the Wi-Fi array, that reduces the number of devices that are deployed out there. So not only do you have central or distributed elements that are within the network, but you're actually centralizing some of those components now into one device through multiple radios, directional antennas. all of this gives you greater performance than right at the edge of the network where the high bandwidth .11 clients are connecting to the network. Application of encryption and decryption, application of policies, VLAN tagging, all of the things that you need to ensure robust, high-performing, and secure Wi-Fi deployment.
So, Jeff, it seems that there are distributed capabilities amongst many of the vendors that are participating in our challenge. How do I distinguish one distributed architecture from another? What are some things to look for if I've decided that my forwarding, at least in some cases, needs to be distributed?
The main things to look for is with respect to the capacity that the system can support. The .11n supports capacities greater than wired LAN infrastructures today, going up to and exceeding 170 megabits per radio. And so now that enables applications that you can't achieve with a wired LAN infrastructure. And another thing I wanted to add is the reason why you can enable it at the edge is that your wired LAN switches today do everything in hardware. And so therefore, there's plenty of capacity in your wired LAN switches to support the upgrade from a legacy ABG network that does around 20 to 24 megabits per radio to a .11n solution that is backward compatible with ABG, but also supports throughput up to and exceeding 170 megabits. So now you have significant capacity deltas. And as Bruce said, I mean, many things can be done at the edge, or pretty much everything can be done at the edge with all the processing capability that is available today. So all of your policy decisions, your encryption with 802.11i, everything can be done at the edge. So capacity, in our mind, is the biggest differentiator between the solutions.
So, Jeff, what do we centralize then?
So that's a great question as well, because the thing that is most important for any deployment is the management of the system. So, management absolutely has to be centralized because that eases the deployment, it eases the upgrades, it eases the network rollouts, it eases the RF management. So you really have to do that in a centralized management, but to allow maximum capacity, you really want to do make all the decisions out at the edge where all the processing should be.
Okay, I'd like Luke from Enterasys Siemens to jump in here. Luke, I believe your organization allows for some adaptive capabilities in that you could support both centralized and distributed switching depending on the situation. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, thanks, Joni. So, yeah, exactly. What we recommend customers is that instead of picking an architecture, use one that's, like you said, adaptive or flexible, one that could be also centralized and decentralized or distributed. If I take the first point, the comment was, with .11n, absolutely you're going to be looking at high bandwidth. But it's not just about high bandwidth applications, although .11n definitely makes it a lot easier to deploy such applications. But the reality is that, for example, voice is not high bandwidth. And then voice has a different challenge, which is basically seamless roaming. So if you've got, like some of our environments, we've got thousands of access points that allow roaming across an entire campus, you probably don't want to have a distributed architecture to support that only because you're going to have a single VLAN to support that. It'd be a lot easier if you support multi-subnet roaming and centrally manage that. So although I'm a big fan on distributed, especially .11n, it's not just the only answer. And then also on with Jeff's comment about central management, absolutely. But one step further is central management, and something that Gartner mentioned also that it's very, becoming very important is not just the central management, which we also offer through our iPath Wireless Manager, centrally managing multiple controllers and EPs, but also that integrated wired wireless, because at the end of the day, though, the network is not just wireless, it's wired also. So it's very important to have an integrated wired wireless management capability centrally, so now you can manage all your security policies, whether they're wired or wireless and so on.
And I would like to ask both Proxim and Xeris, when we talk about centralized management, what is required in your systems for the centralized management capabilities? For example, do I need a dedicated appliance? Can I run server software on the server platform of my choice? What is required of me to get my centralized management? Let's start with Bruce at Xeris.
Yeah, we provide actually both options, an appliance and a software-based solution. So whether or not you want to run on your own server or purchase a dedicated device rack-mountable for the closet, both solutions are available. We basically have an architecture that distributes the switching, the data plane itself and the control plane out to the devices, and the only thing that really comes back to a central management perspective is the management. Based on the nature of the array with an integrated approach, you end up with a lot fewer devices to manage than if you would be managing autonomous APs out there. So the integration aspect lends itself well to simplifying that management issue.
And Bruce, could you give me an example of a scenario where I might opt for the appliance management system versus the server software management system? What would drive me one way or another?
It's really up to the individual IT manager's choice. We have customers that want to manage their own server. We have ones that want a set and forget headless appliance that they can put into the closet and have to worry about patch updates and virus checking and things of that nature. So we provide both options to give our customers the choice. The advantages of the integrated appliance from our perspective is that it's a pre-installed, pre-tested, self-contained system, and I think is probably the most seamless way of getting up and running quickly. Out of the box, it'll discover the network. Out of the box, it will automatically figure out the lay of the land, so to speak, and start to help you manage and set up your network.
Is there a greater cost, Bruce, associated with the appliance rather than the server software?
In both cases, you're purchasing software.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the appliance has an additional cost for the hardware, but it's not significant difference really between the two, no.
Okay. And Jeff, what about an Aproxim deployment? What would be my options for centralized management?
So historically, we have offered both solutions to enterprise and small to medium business, and what we found is that, most people appreciate the flexibility of a softer version that could be loaded onto an existing appliance that they already own. So, for .11n and for managing our end-to-end system, we support a softer version that could be loaded onto a Windows PC, and we just spec out the requirements to support different levels of users.
I see. Luke, did you want to say anything in this part of the discussion about how to actually run my centralized management?
Yeah, I'll just make something real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you're going to be looking for different alternatives. The big thing that we promote is management on a per SSID basis. So you're managing the data plane, control plane, and management plane even on a per SSID basis if you wish. So we offer that full flexibility.
That was on a per SSID basis is what you were saying, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And on per SSID, you can actually have even different management levels from that perspective.
Okay. And Luke, according to your response to our challenge, it sounds as though you support traffic bridging out at the access points. And you talk about stateful preservation of voice over wireless LAN during failures of any kind, be it an AP or a controller. Could you explain how that works a little bit?
Sure, that's a good question. So for those who are not familiar with our architecture, again, it's a distributed architecture, and we can actually support both tunneled and what we call bridge mode, or where the traffic is bridged locally at the AP, like you're asking, Joni. And basically, when you bridge the traffic locally, you can also manage, or the management plane can be in sort of that you can actually have your radius authentication, for example, back of the controller, or leave it local at the AP. Again, for centrally managed, that's, you want to have the advantage of being able to do both, but still centrally managed. But what happens is that, to your question, is that if the EP, for example, gets disconnected somehow to the controller, and for those SSIDs that are configured to locally bridge the traffic, they will continue to operate. In fact, they can continue to operate forever, for example, for authentication, for filtering, for bridging, all those aspects are. And what happens is the AP, as it continues providing service, it actually starts looking for either the controller again or a backup controller if it wishes. And the way it works, it's very simple. The AP is acting just like a standalone access point in this case and basically allows you to locally bridge. So for those of you who have a question, for example, what happens if I use 802.1x to authenticate to the controller, but now my controller is gone? What happens in this case is that you will actually, you know, use up the least time. If you configured it this way, the AP will be able to continue working with the client up to the least time. Now, of course, if you've got an area where links go up and down and you want to make sure that doesn't happen, then you can extend your lease time for as long as you want and plan around a failure. So that's kind of the way it works. And, of course, you can configure this on a per SSID basis. You can do group configurations for multiple EPs to really simplify the entire configuration.
Bruce, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the goals of your high-gain directional antenna-based architecture that makes use of radio arrays for very high capacity. Did you create your architecture to be used in certain applications, such as lecture halls with a whole lot of students requiring a whole lot of bandwidth all at one time? Or how does this architecture, if it does, benefit your everyday carpeted business enterprise environment?
Yeah, so the Xeris Wi-Fi array comes in 4, 8, and 16 radio options. We're adding some additional ones as well. So obviously the higher radio options lend themselves very well towards high capacity environments. But the product itself was designed more general purpose orientation for carpet enterprise, hospitality, all the way up to very high dense environments. And the main concept is really integration, as I mentioned earlier, integrating the radios, the controller, the switch, the firewall, and the antennas all into a single device. So for an enterprise-type deployment, you may use the lower radio count units, maybe the 8 or even the 4, but the bottom line there is by pulling those into an integrated single environment or a single device, you use far fewer devices than a typical AP scenario. The typical ratio that we see is about 4-1. So instead of 4 APs and a central controller, you would have a single array on the ceiling, and then obviously distribute out the number of devices based on the deployment. That ultimately, I think, is the biggest differentiator and advantage that you can point to, because you have fewer devices to install, manage, and maintain, fewer cable runs to pull, fewer switch ports in the closet to purchase as well. And that works very well in a normal kind of enterprise environment, as well as all the way up to very large, high-density applications, lecture halls, for example, in universities, or a conference and exhibition type of scenarios as well.
And Bruce, about the antenna, is the idea that you would use multiple high-gain directional antennas going in multiple directions all at one time, as opposed to fewer omnidirectional antennas, and why is that beneficial?
Yeah, so the directional antenna approach of the array is analogous with cell towers used in the cellular communications world, where you'll typically see them triangular-shaped antenna systems on the side of the freeway or, you know, in metropolitan areas or anywhere, where essentially you have multiple radios, each then focused in a specific direction, but together they add up to an omnidirectional coverage pattern. Because the antennas are directional, they push the range further in one direction, so you get about twice the range in our case, which equals four times the coverage. So that directionality promotes the range, but then allows you to integrate the multiple radios into one device so that altogether the coverage of that one device is greater than a single device with an omnidirectional antenna. And that allows for channel separation as well between the different radios that are coexistent in the same device. I'm focusing my RF energy in one direction and separating those channels from others that might be on adjacent arrays that are on the same channel. So ultimately, for an RF design and management perspective, you have a lot more flexibility with that kind of approach than more of a omnidirectional microcell type of planning technique.
Okay. Now, everybody who's represented on the panel today supports what I would call a microcell architecture, in that the usual planning technique is to alternate channels from AP to AP in sort of a checkerboard or tile pattern. We don't have any single channel architecture vendor support supporting vendors on the panel today. However, that particular type of architecture is another consideration between just distributed and centralized. And I was wondering if perhaps each of you could give me your thoughts on what you feel are pros and cons of the microcell alternating channel architecture vis-a-vis a single channel architecture. And let's start with Jeff at Proxim.
Thanks, Joni. Let me just highlight two major advantages that you get with 802.11n. One is capacity, and the second one is range. With the benefits of MIMO being able to transmit different signals on each antenna, and then to be able to receive the signal on multiple antennas gives you the additional capacity and the additional range. So now the benefit you get with .11n over the legacy solutions is you can get twice the range, which means half the channels already. So .11n amongst itself has already simplified the RF deployment for any network. And by doing so, you still want to be able to maintain AP density so you can get as high a rate as possible to the end user, so you're still being able to provide rates higher than the wired LAN infrastructure. So that's why you still need the density, because your rates roll off the further away you are, the more obstructions you go through. It's just physics. But the big benefit of .11n, in and amongst itself, is twice the distance, half the number of RF channels. So you've now increased your capacity by 2x just from an RF planning perspective. And the other big benefit of .11n with the benefit of range is now all of a sudden your 5 gigahertz frequencies go as far as your 2.4 gigahertz legacy frequencies went. So now it's much more possible to do a deployment 5 gigahertz that actually has about 10 times the number of channels as 2.4 as you did before. So those are many benefits and reasons why the alternating channel is a very effective solution, and why the single channel is no longer needed today.
Luke, I'm curious, did you want to say anything about why, what should the person listening to this discussion today know about single channel versus multicellular architectures?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. I'll keep the discussion within the architecture side. I think Jeff already commented on the microcell aspect. On the architecture side, you're talking about aggregating all the traffic to a controller eventually. And this is the essence of .11n, and I think you'll get from all of us over here, is that, if you're going to start backhauling all of your .11n traffic, I mean, we also sell, and Teresys also sells switches, and I don't mind selling more switches. But the thing is that as a proper architecture, if you're going to backhaul all the traffic, then this is also, to me, this is hogwash. This is real bad architecture, because then again, you're centralizing and tromboning, like we said before, all the traffic. So that's, to me, the microcell architectures are definitely, to me, are flawed in the medium long term because of that issue. And even take it one step further, we talked about, the integrated controller with APs. I think if you leave the discussion regarding, again, that architecture, for small environments, then I would agree. But when you get into environments where you've got 500 access points, or let's say 500 radios for the argument's sake, in our case, you still need only one controller versus multiple controllers. And I think, again, with the distributed architecture, this, again, looks at the big picture, and basically, when you got the best of both worlds, it's definitely hard to beat.
Okay. Last question. Mesh mode could be considered an architectural element of 802.11 systems as well. And many of the 802.11n system architectures that have been coming out seem to support it. I wanted to ask you folks what you think some of the best mesh applications might be and what, if any, vulnerabilities or downsides there might be to running your traffic in mesh mode. I think it's Bruce's turn. What do you think about mesh? Do I use it? When do I use it? Pros, cons?
Yes, I think that certainly there's a lot of benefits of deploying a mesh type of environment and having the flexibility of using wireless for a backhaul in particular. Some of the things that we've seen with respect to mesh and the deployments that we've made provide trenching alternatives. Instead of, for example, needing to trench cable into a soccer field, in one example we had in a deployment in a college environment, a simple point-to-point mesh saved literally, $50,000 or what have you for the equivalent amount of money it would take to actually put multiple lines into a long-haul kind of application. Within a campus environment, building-to-building connections can be simplified with mesh as opposed to trenching, or can be used as redundancy options as well. So using, standard networking protocols, the backup wireless mesh connection can be a backup on standby if the wired connection actually went down, if a cable got cut, for example. So that's a big one. And then I think the third primary area there is in temporary installations. We do a number of things with events, conventions, things of this nature, where it's very easy to set up Wi-Fi devices in a temporary environment and backhaul them to a central point and be able to set up and tear down very briefly. In fact, emergency response is another one that lends itself very well to that as well, where you don't have to pull the cable, but you can quickly deploy a product and connect it back through its wireless connection and be up and running very, very, very quick.
And Jeff and Luke, I hear occasionally an IT manager tell me, gee, I'm kind of worried about the mesh for my traditional carpeted indoor business environment. It just seems, how do they phrase it, perhaps a little more vulnerable to have more things wireless. I'm wondering what you would say to reassure that individual. Jeff.
Thanks a lot, Joni.
Jeff, presuming that you are indeed a backer of mesh.
Yes, definitely a backer of mesh. Thanks. I guess the first thing I would say is that the IEEE standardized 802.11i more than 5 years ago, and it's been more than 2 years, I think about 2.5 years, that the Wi-Fi Alliance actually requires 802.11i security, or WPA2, is a mandatory part of getting Wi-Fi certification. So for the past several years now, every single device that's been certified by the Wi-Fi Alliance supports WPA2. So the wireless network is extremely secure, and just as a point of fact, the government uses 128-bit AES encryption. So if it's good enough for them, it's definitely good enough for the rest of the applications. But the enterprises deploying WPA2 today, secure the wireless infrastructure, and as long as that is used on your mesh links as well, which it is on our solutions, then you're getting the benefits of the AES encryption, which is securing the link, plus all the key rotation you get with WPA2, so it maintains that security. So definitely, it's it is as secure as a wired LAN.
Okay, but Luke, what about when I say vulnerability, there's the security aspect of that, certainly, as Jeff from Proxim points out. What about from just a high availability standpoint? Would a mesh architecture be more or less resilient, or does that depend on the vendor in general? Do we know the answer to that yet?
So the big thing, what we tell our customers, because our software basically allows you to wirelessly connect EAPs together with redundant paths. We don't call it a full mesh, but basically it's a alternative that where you can actually use a fast spanning tree algorithm to bridge over a bunch of EPs. And if an EP fails, you know, it can go on a backup link and still connect to the wire network. So that's our solution. So going back to your question is, well, we tell customers, you're asking about the vulnerabilities. And we all know that RF has a lot of vulnerabilities for interference, heavy use, and so on. So therefore, what we tell our customers is pretty simple. It's, if you've got a wire, you know, put the spigot in the AP and then basically, you know, plug the AP in is what I'm saying. And basically that allows you to have the greatest bandwidth. And especially with .11n, that's what people are looking for. But in areas where you need to expand wirelessly, whether it's from a small building to another, whether it's actually from to a booth or whether you want to extend within a convention center just without pulling any cables, absolutely use WDS. We've got lots of customers doing it. It's just that when you're running wireless over, you know, to wireless, you run and you're aggregating traffic over wireless, then you've got a lot more traffic that can be impacted regarding interference. So it's always best, if you can, to use a wire to plug into the EP.
Joni, if I could add something there?
Certainly.
Yeah, this is Bruce from Zurich. One other point with respect to WDS and using wireless for backhaul that is key is focusing on the 5 gig spectrum where you have many, many more channels available to you and where the interference is much less than in 2.4. So I think with the opening up from the FCC in the last couple of years here of additional channels, when it comes to mesh and the vulnerabilities and the interference concerns, having the ability to use the upper 5 gig channels and provide dedicated links for wireless backhaul has made it a much more secure and interference-free and reliable type of connection than it was maybe in the past. And that's certainly what we see as well. In our product, we have dedicated radios which can be used for those links. So you can lock up the point-to-point links for your mesh backhaul and still have other radios available for user servicing. And that makes it very robust because it's dedicated, it's in interference-free, relatively interference-free channels, and it's dedicated for that application.
And also, this is Luke, to add to that, I totally agree. Make sure that, you know, for those listeners, make sure to look for a product that's DFS2 compliant. Because then you can have a lot more limited number of channels with the 5 gig spectrum. So this is something to look for. And a lot of these advantages too could be used. You could use channel bonding to basically backhaul your traffic and use the second radio. In our case, it's configurable, so you can actually use the second radio to either communicate, get users connected to it, or continue backhauling.
And just for those listeners who maybe didn't quite pick up on that, Luke was referring to DFS2 compliance, which is certification from either the FCC or other worldwide regulatory body for use of all the 5 gigahertz channels in the so-called middle band, which opens up a lot more channels and bandwidth availability for designing your network. Those bands also may contain some military or weather radar, and being certified for DFS means that the products are allowed to coexist in those bands and just need to be able to hop out of the way if necessary. Is everybody on this panel, are your systems all DFS2 certified? Luke, it sounds like yours is. Jeff, what about Proxim?
Yes, we have both FCC and ETSI certification for all the 5.3, 5.4, and 5.8 gigahertz bands.
Excellent. Bruce, what about Zurich?
Yes, yeah, same thing. We're certified, so a total of 24 5 gig channels that are available for use within the product.
Excellent. So it looks like we're running out of time here, but I wanted to thank everybody for joining me today on this panel about architectures, what are they, how important are they, what are the pros and cons of them. I would encourage anybody listening, if you would like further information, to contact any of the folks who have participated today and or read their written responses to our 11N challenge that are posted at WebTorials. Those pieces get into their various architectures and schemes a little bit more deeply than we talked about today. And with that, I'm going to turn this back to Robin.
Thanks, Joni. I want to thank you for leading a very good discussion, and a special thanks to Luke, Jeff, and Bruce for their valuable input in the 802.11n architecture. This is just one of five discussions we are having on 802.11n issues, so I encourage you to check out the other sessions. Like Joni mentioned, you can find out more about each vendor's solutions by going to the challenge page at WebTorials. I also want to encourage you to contact any of our sponsors for more information on this or any other 802.11 topic, and let them explain how they can help you build a better wireless solution. Again, thank you for your time.